I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 67 of Season 6 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is John Parker of the Bat Minute. Welcome back to the show, John.
Thanks for having me back. I've got to speak like Batman for the whole time now.
Okay, I thought you were trying to do like an evil Potter voice, you know, making the Potter. I was thinking maybe like Potter sounded like the Emperor or something like that. I thought that's what you were trying to do here.
Oh my God, that would be great. Can someone do, a listener to the show, please do like a mock-up of Potter as the Emperor, please. Get him in the robe and everything and lightning coming out of his hands. That'd be great.
Who knows? That might work.
It would work, right? It would.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think Ian McDiarmid would do as good of a job here as Lionel Barrymore does, but nobody can. I mean, come on, he is one of the best villains in movies. I mean, again, let's not talk about sci-fi and stuff like that, but I guess he's the best real life type of villain.
I can see that. Because you instantly hate him.
That's right. He's not like Hans Gruber. Hans Gruber is a great villain, but you don't hate him. He's a great villain because you love him. But this is a villain that you like want to hate. Yeah. That's right.
But this guy, immediately, without him even speaking, you can see on his face, like, oh, he's bad. I don't like him.
Yeah. Which shows how great of an actor Lionel Barrymore really was. Because, I mean, I know that you mentioned yesterday you haven't seen any other Frank Capra movies. But so he's in some other Frank Capra movies. And you know, you Can't Take It With You, he plays a happy-go-lucky guy. I mean, it's completely 180-degree turn from this one. Yes.
Oh, I do like it when filmmakers use, like, a core cast. I always like it when they bring people back again and again. It feels more like a theater company that way.
But are you saying that only when the characters are when they play different types of characters, or when they play the same type of character over and over?
I'm happy either way. I just like to see like people as a team, you know. So bring them back and do different roles, you know, do whatever you want with them, but just have your core people you like working with, sprinkle in some new people, because it feels more old fashioned to me in a good way, you know, like again, like a theater production. You see a theater troupe, it's often the same people, but they'll be doing, you know, different plays.
Right. No, I agree with you on that. I mean, Christopher Nolan does that really well.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, if you go back here, so you have Frank Capra did it well, Howard Hawks did it well. You know, you have a lot of the old-time directors that would do that also. To me, I don't like the way that Martin Scorsese does it, though.
Okay. There's a difference.
Because he, in some ways, uses pretty much the same actors in different types of in different movies where they're playing more or less the same type of character.
Yeah, I do like him, but his movies.
No, I'm not saying I don't like his movies. I love his movies, but I'm saying when you look at some of the characters, it's hard to differentiate. Like, you know, I recently just saw, you know, his latest movie, the Killers of.
Flower Moon,
something like that. Yeah. Yes, the
someone. Yeah, I haven't seen it yet because it's apparently really long, isn't it? And I'm like, I'm old.
I was very shocked that it was so long. It's called the Killers of the Flower Moon. So yeah, I was very shocked that it's 3 hours and 40 minutes. So it's just like it really hit me. I wasn't even prepared for to go into a movie that long.
No,
and
which I'm okay with a movie that long, but at home
I need to be prepared. No, I need to be prepared. That's what it comes down to. I don't mind long movies. For me, The Lord of the Rings, you can only watch the extended version. The others don't mean anything. So
Oh, I 100% agree. Yeah.
it's fine watching, a almost 5 hour version of Return of the King. That's okay. I enjoy that. It's fun. It's great. But if you don't know that that's what you're going into, that's where the problem
Yeah.
arises.
You've got to mentally, and again, I prefer, even though it's a big spectacle movie, that I do prefer watching it at home because I can pause, I can go to the bathroom, I can get snacks, I can
Correct.
enjoy it more than sitting there 3 hours in, desperately needing to
That's right.
relieve myself and struggling.
That's right. Back to what we were talking about yesterday with the Return of the Jedi. I still remember to this day, and what is it? It's been now 40 years since Return of the Jedi came out, 40 and a half years. Okay, so approximately 40 years ago, one of the times I went, I had drunk so much beforehand, I missed half the movie because I ran to the bathroom like seven times in the middle of the movie. Because, but I mean, I had seen it, so I had seen it before, so I didn't wasn't missing anything from that perspective. But I still remember, I went with a friend of mine named John Prostack. I remember we went to go see it. It was I used to be able to know who I saw all 17 times with. Like I said, oh, I went to the
Wow.
first time with this one, second time with that one, and like I had a list even at the time of when I saw it and with who. It's been lost, over the decades. But I remember distinctly which friend I went to where I had to run out and go to the bathroom so many times in the middle of the movie. I was a 9-year-old. What do you expect? I couldn't
Well,
hold it in, but whatever.
as I age, I'm accepting my limitations now. I another thing all movies should do, right? All movies, unless they're like 90 minutes, intermission, right? I know why they don't do it, because they think, well, we can cram more movies in if there's no intermission. But you know what? I think it's a win-win for everybody. It's a win for me because I get to, go to the bathroom. I get to go and buy more drinks and snacks. So it's a win for them. They're making more money that way because the drinks and snacks cost a fortune.
Right. That's true.
So I think it would pay off. I think it would benefit them if they put in intermissions again.
I agree. I mean, I live in a country that has always had intermissions up until just a few years ago,
Oh,
where
you're
there were
lucky.
always intermissions. The problem was is they would always have the intermissions at the most terrible time. It wasn't at the end of a scene, it was in the middle of a scene.
No.
And
Oh.
the last and I remember they did away with having intermissions here. And then when Avengers Endgame came out, I believe, I'm pretty
Oh,
sure it was
yeah.
Endgame, that was the first time that they actually had an intermission. And I remember the line to the bathroom.
Well, it's a long time to be sitting somewhere,
Yes.
especially as you get older. I've got to go a lot more than maybe I used
Okay, that's true. That is definitely true.
to.
So, minute 67 begins with the rent collector making an analogy and ends with Sam having to leave. So, we ended things yesterday with the conversation between Potter and this rent collector. And one of the things I neglected to talk about yesterday was the fact that the rent collector mentions something very important. He talks about the fact that 15 years ago, a half dozen houses stuck up here and there, right? So this, given just thinking of the visual of this, says so much about what's going on in this movie.
Oh,
Again,
yeah.
so 15 years ago, it means that George was not in charge of the building and loan at the time. That was still Peter that was in charge of it. Okay,
Yes, it will be.
so it was Peter who started Bailey Park. Which it doesn't sound like, I always assumed that George named Bailey Park in honor of his father.
Yes, I would have thought
Okay,
the same thing, yeah.
exactly. But when he says that 15 years ago there were sparse houses here, maybe it wasn't called Bailey Park at the time, but it says that that's where Peter Bailey was sprouting up houses. Okay, but they also say that it was sparsely. Meaning that Peter wasn't as successful as George is now. You can read
Exactly. And
into that just from this dialogue. It's just amazing.
I think maybe like it being sparse as well, maybe in the past there wasn't like a real concrete plan. It was just like, oh, we'll build some houses when people need some houses. But George has like coalesced it into like a community.
That's
He's
right.
like, no, hang on. If we structure this right and we build You know, we can make this into something.
Correct. No, I think it's just, again, the dialogue here is so descriptive in telling us what things that are going on. And they do that really well.
That's the real strength of the movie. I mean, visuals, yeah, obviously we said, but dialogue to me, it's the dialogue, except for the hee-haw, because it does annoy me.
Yeah, it's a little annoying.
But yeah, no, I think that annoys, it's supposed to be annoying.
Yeah, I think so either. I think so too. Yeah.
Yeah. But no, the dialogue is fantastic. And as we've said a few times, it just reveals so much about this guy. Like, I love that he kind of both insults Bailey and praises him.
That's right.
And infers that, like, look, I'm going to go work for him because I might not necessarily agree with his, you know, his politics or whatever, but he's going to be doing a better job than you. And he, you know, he's going to look after me.
That's right.
He maybe thinks he's a bit of an idiot. Like, he's an idiot for not maximizing his profits like you, Potter. And he's an idiot because he's going to treat me well. So I'm going there.
That's right. Right. But he starts off with a great comment. And he says, and are the local yokels making with those David and Goliath wisecracks?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Basically, what he's telling Potter is that people are talking. They're saying that George Bailey is better at this than you are. You know, you may be the Goliath, but he's the David. You know, this is the idea of an underdog.
Yeah, yeah. And he's offering them something that they want and they need for a better price than you would ever. He wouldn't offer them anything they actually need. It would just be some piece of junk. But Bailey's offering them something good and it's affordable and he's helping them.
That's right. That's right.
So how do you top that?
That's right. And, I mean, Potter himself is a little shocked by it. He says, oh, they are they? Mm-hmm. And he goes, even though they know that Bailey's never made a dime out of it. So, like, again, why would people care? If I bought a house and I knew that the person that helped me build this house didn't make any money off of it, I would think more highly of them than
well, that's the thing. That's the way this guy thinks. And that's the circles he moves in. He doesn't understand. But why would you do that? Like, to his friends, that would be mocked, you know.
That's right. And then the rent collector says, you know very well why. The Baileys were all chumps. Every one of these homes is worth twice what it cost the building and loan to build. If I were you, Mr. Potter, you are not me. As I said, it's no skin off my nose. But one of these days, this bright young man is going to be asking George Bailey for a job.
Yeah, I love that. Because, again, he's not saying this is definitely the way to do things, because I think he's acknowledging that you know, there's not really any money in doing this, but you know, you're going to go out of business and you know, you're not a nice guy. You're not, what are you doing for me?
That's right. Yeah, no, it's just done really well. You know, the whole thing.
That's why he's a great character.
Do you know what a chump is?
I mean, I don't know the origins of it, but I know, you know, it's an insult. Chump.
It's a person who is easily tricked or a stupid or foolish person.
Hmm.
You know, which again, you know, this rent collector is looking at the phrase from the perspective that, you know, the Baileys are chumps because they could have made a lot more money than they did.
Yeah, yeah.
So it shows this guy isn't as pure as he might sound here. You know, it shows that he actually, there's a reason why he's working for Potter.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's what I mean. He's not a moralistic kind of person. He's a money guy at the end of the day.
That's right.
But he sees where this is going. He sees the future. And he's like, well, I need to hitch my wagon to this, basically, unless you turn this around right now.
Yeah. But it's ironic because if he's a money guy, how, you know, he doesn't think he's going to be able to make money working for Bailey. I mean, what kind of money is he going to make working for Bailey? At this point, if Bailey is the type of guy who doesn't know who's not really making money off of things. So why would I want to go work for someone like that if I don't think of the moral issues of it?
I think there's a couple of points to it. It's number one, I think he may see a future where Potter, he goes out of business. So he can't work for Potter. He's going to have to go somewhere. And the number one guy in town is going to be Bailey, no matter what, at this point. So it's the, you know, that's where I can get employment. the guy who's going to succeed in this war. And also, I don't know, because I don't really understand how rent collectors worked in this era, but would Bailey
What do you mean, knock, 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 pay your rent or get out?
Well, that's the thing, but he's collecting that for a company. So yes. I assume he is he salaried? So maybe he knows George will give me a good wage?
Maybe. My assumption is, and I didn't look this up, but my assumption is that rent collectors probably made a percentage of what they collected.
You get like a cut of it. Okay, yeah.
I would think that, because that's more of an incentive for them to go and, you know, and, you know, you think it from the mob perspective.
Yeah.
You know, when the guy has to go and collect money from, you know, from everyone who has to pay up, you know, monthly. If they don't pay up, then they have to then pay the boss the difference.
Yeah, true. Maybe it is something like that. So then that would tie into what I said first then. Maybe he just accepts, like, George is so successful at this right now. Everybody wants to move to his new place. You're going to go bust. So if I want to keep working, that's where I'm going.
Correct. So we'll have to wait and see, because that doesn't really happen, but it would have been interesting to see.
they could do a sequel after all these years where they follow a different timeline.
That's right.
Oh God, no, I shouldn't even put that out there into the ether. Someone's going to make it now. No, please don't, Hollywood, don't.
That's right. I mean, it does sound like a hollow threat. Yeah. And does, I love how he says this young man, this bright young man. He doesn't look that young. He might be bright.
No.
But he does not look that young.
That is a problem I have with older movies, right? Everybody, both as human beings, right, they look older than they are. They Correct. Look more mature for their age. And they also cast people who are too old for the part. So it's a double sort. So they look even older again.
Right.
But I think maybe in this case, it's because they, you know, they wanted one guy to play the part throughout.
Right.
As he gets, you know, he goes from one age to the next to the next. So I get it. Like, they didn't want to have different, except for when he's a little kid, they didn't want to have different actors in there.
Correct. Yeah, no, but I mean, we've talked about this numerous times over this season. You know, a lot of the actors, you know, we see that they're like in their 50s or early 60s, yeah. And they look so much older than that.
Yeah, it was a thing back then. People looked older. I don't know why. I don't know what's changed.
Yeah, I don't know either.
How old is Potter really here? He's probably not that old, right? He looks like an old man.
Well, again, we have to go back and look at the history of Potter to try to figure this one out, because, you know, Potter himself was in he's in the first segment of the movie, which takes place in 1919, and he's already there, an older man. And then, you know, we see him towards the end of this movie at the end of 1945. So that's a span of 26 years. Yeah. And he was already known as Old Man Potter, you know, in 1919.
That's true, actually. Yeah, bloody him.
So, you know, the 26-year difference, let's go out on a limb and say, okay, at the end of the movie, he's 70. 75. He's 75. Mm. So it means that in the beginning of the movie, he's already 50.
Ah, it's weird to think about. Yeah. On the actor as well. Like, how old is he? He can't.
Well, Lionel Barrymore,
as old as he looks.
Okay, Lionel Barrymore was born in 1878. So when this movie came out in 1946, okay, so he was 68, if I did my math correctly.
Oh, okay. You know what? He's a rare one who bucks the trend then, because I think he looks good for his age.
Well, he looks older than 68.
Yeah, but considering what we're saying is everybody looked older back then. I don't think he looks... Normally, when someone's 68 back then, they look about 100.
Okay, that's true.
He doesn't look like awful. He doesn't look like he's about to die.
No, not at all. He looks like he's going to outlive everyone in this movie.
Yeah, you get that vibe from him, don't you? One of these rich old people who just lingers.
That's right. I think it's because he made a pact with the devil or something.
It's like our royal family here. They live on and on and on. It's like, oh, gee, how are you still alive? You know?
It's a very good question.
I mean, the Queen only just died. I don't know how she didn't die about 20 years ago.
It's something in the water.
It must be. It's the benefits of being rich.
That is very possible.
You can look after yourself and have good doctors and eat the best food. Although if I was rich, I'd eat the most bad for you food I could possibly get my hands on, probably.
Yeah, but you'd still have the best doctors taking care of you while you're eating all that crap.
They would fix the problems that the food causes.
That's right. So, it's a chicken and the egg.
Exactly. And Potter's the same, isn't he? Like, I think that's why, maybe that's why he's old man Potter. Everyone's like, oh, is he still around? God damn it. And that's how, because he's like, well, I'm rich. Especially in America, where you've got to pay for all your healthcare, you know. He's like, well, I can get the best of the best.
That's true. And then Potter basically decides, you know, he finally is fed up with what this rent collector is saying. And he goes, the Bailey family has been a boil on my neck long enough. And then he pushes the buttons, and we hear a woman on the intercom. Yes, sir. Come in here.
It's interesting to me as well that this is like his moment to sort of say to the viewer, that's it. It's war. You know, I'm going to take them down. But really, not to spoil things, listeners, how he does eventually almost take them down fully, it's almost like an accident.
Yes.
He sort of just accidentally steals money. You know, it's not a grand plan, a scheme he comes up with. It's like, oh, no, hang on, let's just take this.
And he doesn't even realize it at the beginning.
No.
You know, he just said, oh, I got a free newspaper, you know.
It's wild to me because, again, any other movie, you would be like, okay, this is where he starts plotting and scheming and coming up with, you know, this dastardly plan to take down Bailey. No. He basically sits there just sort of thinking, oh, what am I going to do?
That's right. Oh, wait a second. Look what I just found.
Great. Everything's solved. Wonderful.
That's right.
Wasn't that a great, happenstance?
Exactly. And I mean, it's great also that they show us that he calls his secretary into the room, but we never find out what he says to her.
No.
You know, just again, it's some evil plan.
That's part of the plan. Yeah. Like, oh, bring her in because I need her to take notes. No.
That's right.
No.
That's right.
Unless he does have a plan, but because of the accidental theft, he doesn't need to do the plan anymore. He's like, oh, no.
No, but the plan. But that plan takes place 15 years later. I mean, it's not, or 12 years later.
It's a long-term plan.
Yes. Well, no, we'll see. We'll see towards the end of this week, you know, his immediate plan to see what he's trying to do here.
Yeah, it's not the best scheme. But, you know, he's trying.
Yes.
Maybe it's to show that he's out of touch now. He's old. You know, he doesn't know how to do this anymore. Things have changed in the business.
Possibly. And then the scene changes, and we're back at the at Bailey Park with the martinis, and or at the Martini House. And then
Jane's incredible outfit. That's the most important thing.
For sure.
Look at her. Oh my God.
You know, and I mean, we actually now find out who this is. But, I mean, first of all, we see that Sam says, well, we just stopped in town to take a look at the new factory, and then we're going to go drive on down to Florida. which is pretty funny because, I mean, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but if you look at the U.S. geography, to drive from upstate New York to Florida, that's a pretty far drive.
Yeah, like I don't know a lot about America, but even I know that, like, that's like a real trek.
Yeah, and think about it. This is 1933, so you can't even, you know, you can look it up now. Now, if you were to drive approximately, let's say it's from Buffalo, because, you know, that's as the closest big city, I guess you can say, to where they are. maybe Buffalo, maybe Rochester, but probably Buffalo because the fact that they sing Buffalo Girls. So it's probably closer to that. Okay, it's a 19-hour and 14-minute drive from upstate New York down to Florida.
That is just, that's unheard of to me. See, England's very small.
You're talking about small.
Well,
I live in this.
I didn't want to speak for you. Yeah. But like, you know, if there's an event on that's like 2 hours away from me, I'm like, nah, I'm not going to that. That's too far. No. I don't even go to Manchester. I live in Liverpool. Manchester's next door. Sometimes I won't even go there to see a band I like because it's like, I have to get on the train. That's like an hour.
I commute to work more than an hour every day each way.
Yeah. I used to be honest. I did used to. But my new job, it's only in the city center. So it's 20 minutes on a bus. And then 3 days a week, I get to work from home.
Ooh, yeah. Fun.
Amazing. Yeah.
And you get the podcast while you're working.
I haven't done that yet, but I was tempted to the other day. I think I could pull it off because there's some tasks I do that are like super repetitive. I don't mean that in a bad way, but I could do other things while I'm doing it.
Yes. You know? I understand that. I'm very familiar. Hint, hint. Hint, hint.
No, but that is one hell of a drive. I can't even imagine doing that. Like my band just did some, my band, I'm not the singer, but our band did some gigs in Europe, and it's expensive to fly. So we're not going to do that. You don't make money in music anymore. So we drove from England, and you take the van onto a train, and the train goes under the sea to France. And then you drive from France through the Netherlands, through Belgium, you go to Germany, you know, it's like, oh, I don't know how our driver survived doing that. That was one hell of a trip.
Oh, wow.
And it still wasn't as long as this, I don't think.
Yeah, probably not. I mean, 19 hours is a lot. And again, this is 19 hours today. So it must have been even longer.
True, this car will be slower.
The car would be slower. The roads wouldn't be as paved, I guess you can say. Yeah, they probably didn't have the same interstates and things like that. So, yeah, that's just crazy. So apparently, you know, Jane and Sam are going to be staying in numerous motels on the way and have to find a place for their chauffeur to sleep also.
Maybe that's part of the fun, though. Maybe they are viewing it as like a tour. You know, like I know my dad used to ride motorbikes a lot and, you know, they'd go on long journeys together for days. Mm-hmm. That was part of the joy was, you know, seeing places along the way. So maybe that's how they're viewing the trip.
Possibly. It's very possible. I mean, the next line already says that, you know, Jane turns to Sam and goes, well, why don't you have your friends join us?
Yeah.
So I actually find that to be a really strange comment that the way she says it, why don't you have your friends? So she doesn't know them. She's never met them. You know, they weren't invited to the wedding.
I do get from what they say, they don't know her, do they? Like, is this their first time seeing her?
Yeah, this is the first time that we see Jane. Because the last time that we saw Sam, he was theoretically, you know, trying to court Mary, even though there was a woman that was in this that was there with him, which it's possible that was Jane.
I never thought about that. Yeah, I always assumed this was like they've never like George has never seen this woman. You know?
Oh, George has never seen the woman because again, the last time it was Sam was on the phone and we saw the shot in New York City.
Oh, I see what you mean. We saw. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we did.
It's interesting though because I had never thought about this. I thought, okay, yeah, sometimes you don't meet someone until a bit later on, but to not be invited to the wedding, that's bold, especially for back then where it was a big deal. Whereas now, you know, I have friends who are like, oh, I'm going to get married. And it's just like at the registry office, we call it, you know, where you just go and sign some documents. And like, it doesn't matter. Who cares? But back then it was like a big, 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 big deal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have trying to remember back if Sam was at their wedding.
Mm.
I don't.
You would hope so. He's a good friend.
He's a good friend, but I don't remember seeing him there. Even though, you know, we saw a lot of characters at the wedding. There were characters that were at the wedding that we weren't expecting to be there, and vice versa. You know,
can we maybe infer that George not going to this wedding then is because he's, you know, Sam's become so successful that maybe he doesn't spend a lot of time back here anymore. So maybe they didn't get married here. And George is like, well, I can't get away. Like, I haven't got the money to go down south or wherever the hell he's getting married, you know?
Right. Now, probably in New York, because he was talking about the fact that they were in New York City.
But maybe for the wedding, or was that for, maybe that was like a honeymoon or something?
No, it was before they got married. So, I just rewatched the wedding scene, and Sam is not there. You know, so some best friend he is.
It's that's strange.
Then again, Mary's brother isn't there either. We don't see Marty Hatch, so that already says some strange things also.
Yeah, wonder what that, from a filmmaking perspective, like why would you do that?
They didn't want to pay the extras on that day.
Well, maybe it was cheaper.
You know, the most of the people that we see at the wedding are not known characters.
Very odd. Very odd. I genuinely think you might be onto something with the money, because if you were writing it, you would write it as, well, of course, all his friends are there.
No, but we have one other issue here. Also, we can look at it from the perspective that, you know, maybe they got married very quickly. There wasn't time for anyone to show up. I mean, it wasn't a shotgun wedding that we know. Because, you know, she's not with child at this point. So, yeah. So you don't have to worry about it from that perspective. But the idea is that it is possible that, you know, when they filmed the wedding scene, they just said, okay, well, you know, no one's going to be, you know, 77 years from now, nobody's going to be looking at this movie, you know, the way that we're doing it. So no, who cares?
Of course not. What a stupid idea. Who would do that?
Yeah, completely. So no one will notice. Everyone will just assume that they were there.
Yeah, it probably is that. Like,
yeah.
But I do get the vibe that maybe George seems like someone who would probably just say, you know what, let's get married. Let's do it. You know, he's quite impulsive in some way. He wants to be adventurous and impulsive. And like, I could imagine him saying to her, let's get married right now. Let's do it. Why not? We're in love.
You know? Okay. That's possible. I mean, we talked a little bit about it a few weeks ago, but that is a possibility.
Yeah.
You know, we've no concrete
evidence
either way.
And then it would limit
who
could come. Cause I had a friend who did that. And so I had to not go because there was no way I could get to it. And they were like, oh, it doesn't matter. You know,
and that's
have a
now
party at another date anyway.
So. And that's now. Think about how difficult it might've been to travel back, you know, back in the 1930s.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I was only going to have to travel 3 hours.
Well, we already know that you're lazy when it comes to travel.
I spend a lot of time on the road. I don't want to spend my free time traveling.
That's right. Makes sense. And then Sam says something very strange. He goes, why, sure, hey, why don't you kids drive down with us, huh?
Yeah, aren't they the same age?
That's right. Sam and George are the exact same age. Mary's a little bit younger, but still.
Well, here's something, actually. I'd never thought about this. It's only just dawned on me when you said that sentence. Is that maybe yet another clue that Sam's getting a little bit too big for his boots, a little bit cocky? He's like, well, it's like infantilizing George a little bit. Like, he's calling him a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because he's not, part of you're it. Not doing as well as me. I'll take care of you.
That's right. Which we'll come back to at the end of the movie.
That's interesting to me. Because I don't think he means it deliberately. I don't think he's trying to be belittling.
No, but he's being a little disparaging. You know, it's a way of disparaging to your friend a little bit. Okay, I can understand that.
Well, a bit like when he mentions it comes up yet again. You know, George not taking up the job offer to work in plastics.
Right.
Which I also saw as yet another example of this movie slowly, subtly making George sort of question everything. I think this is starting the journey towards what we see of the suicide attempt.
Yes, you know, but that's only 12 years later. Think about that.
It's a slow burn. The seeds are being planted. These thoughts in his head, you know, because we know he's right. He's fighting the good fight, you know. But to him, that's like more evidence that, you know, everyone's succeeding without him. He's missed his chance. People don't need him.
But apparently people do.
Well, we know that, having seen the whole movie. But, you know, he's thinking to himself, like, in slow, subtle bits, building and building, like, why am I here? I'm holding everyone back almost.
Well, he's been saying that all his life.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's the question.
That's how these things happen, though, isn't it? It's not like, not to be too deep, but, you know, like depression and stuff. I used to work in mental health. That was my old job. And, you know, that's how a lot of this occurs. It's not one incident that, oh, now you're depressed. It's like slow builds of things, you know. It sort of creeps up.
Which makes sense. Mm. You know, these things, as you said, they don't happen overnight.
Yeah, too many movies have like one thing. Oh, they snap. And now they're depressed. Now they're going to try and kill themselves. Like, this is more realistic to me, more believable.
Right. I definitely agree with you on that one. And basically, I mean, the conversation gets a little stranger also between them, because then, you know, he responds to Sam and says, oh, I'm afraid I couldn't get away, Sam. Mm. You know, which sounds sort of just like an excuse.
Absolutely. I do think it probably would be hard for him to get away, but that's not what he's saying. He doesn't want to go. Because I think he would feel, again, it would make him feel bad. It's like...
It would remind him of the possible mistake that he made.
Exactly, right? I think that's why he doesn't like seeing him, even though he's his friend.
Right.
It's just a reminder of...
Right. Okay.
He feels he's failed a little bit. So imagine hanging out with him for 19 hours on the road, and then when they get there as well, like, oh, jeez.
Yeah, and then forget about that, 19 hours back also.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Those are the worst, you know, travel plans. When you go somewhere with somebody and you have a terrible time, and then you say to yourself, oh, my God, I have to go back with them too.
Oh, no, that would be the worst. Yeah, and I think he feels bad, even though he shouldn't, on behalf of his wife.
Right, that's right.
You know, he feels like less of a man almost. Like, correct. I'm supposed to look after you like he's looking after her, you know, and you see how well she's dressed in comparison, even though I think both styles are amazing. But, you know, in the language of the film, it's like, oh, look how luxurious her accessories are and all.
Correct. And then, I mean, and then Sam says to him, well, still got the nose to the old grindstone, eh? Then he turns to his wife and goes, Jane, I offered to let George in on the ground floor in plastics, and he turned me down cold.
This is it.
So,
yeah.
So wait a second. He didn't. Jane doesn't know this yet. What type of marriage is this? You know, we're going to go visit my friend, but I'm not going to tell you anything about him. And by the way, this is a guy that I wanted to help get rich also, and he didn't want it.
Well, this is the old days where to be a married couple, you didn't actually have to communicate or have anything in common with each other.
Apparently.
You weren't best friends then. It was more an arrangement.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, then again, you look at her outfit, you know, she seems to be there because of the extravagant lifestyle. It's a very superficial way to look at it, you know, but that, we don't know anything about her.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the actress...
I'm sure she probably does love him, but at the same time, we have to take it on surface level, you know.
Correct. I mean, the actress who plays Jane is an actress named Marion Carr, who was born in 1925 and passed away in 2003 at the age of 78. Oh. So when this movie came out, she was 21.
See, you this know. Is what I mean, and I don't mean this as an insult to her at all. That woman does not look 21.
She looks younger or older?
Older. I think it's the style, it's the mannerisms. That everyone was more, I guess you had to mature quicker. And again, that's not an insult. She looks amazing. But... To me, a 21, as someone who's about to hit 40, a 21-year-old now, they look like a child.
Right.
This woman does not look like a child.
But is it because of her outfit? Because of all the jewels and the fur and all that stuff?
It's part of it. It's definitely part of it. I think it's just as well, yeah, it's the way people back then had to be, the way they held themselves, you know? it's very different. That they're much more adult, much more mature at an earlier age.
Yeah.
I think you had to be. There was no other way. You know, you didn't get to have your childish, you know, hobbies and things anymore.
Right. Okay, that's fair. That's fair. She actually doesn't have very many entries in IMDb. She was only in 31 movies, which for most of the people in this movie, that's nothing. I mean, we had people that had over 300 IMDb credits. Yeah. You know, so 31
is to churn them out back then. Just get it. You'd come off set and go to the next one.
That's right. Or you'd be working the same time.
Yeah.
And then basically the, you know, George Turnham goes, oh, don't rub it in. And he goes, I'm not rubbing it in. And then Sam turns to Jane and goes, well, I guess we better run along. Meaning, okay, I've had enough here.
Yeah. Again, like, I'm sure he's not rubbing it in, but of course it's going to seem that way to George. Like this, Sam needs to know when to just cool it a bit, you know?
Right. I mean, it's great, like, that they show us, we just by looking at the two couples, you see the very difference between the levels of their lifestyles.
Yes, yeah. Which is funny, you know, going by today's standards, because, you know, the Baileys there, they look by modern day, dress and things, they look like they're very rich to me. But by, you know, in this era, that was just common, you know, clothes and things like that.
That's right. So, and that's how this minute ends. Did you have anything else to say about this minute?
No, that's everything.
Okay. All right, great. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track, Uplifting Story Edition, where my guest will give some sort of story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure, something that's happened to them over the course of their life that is somehow, has somehow related to an uplifting story. So, John, you have a story for us?
Well, I thought I would stretch the concept of the rules slightly, right?
Of course.
Because I was like, okay, all my stories just sound like I'm rubbing it in, like I'm bragging about what an amazing person I am. Oh, I helped, you know, rescue this dog that I found. I was like, I don't want to talk about that. That makes me sound like a jerk.
No, the idea, just so you know, the idea is more of a situation that you were in that possibly someone else inspired you or gave you or uplifted you.
Well, that kind of ties into what I thought then, because I thought, well, I'll stretch the concept a little bit, because I find something uplifting and inspiring and fascinating connected to this movie, but has also happened in my life, sort of. So at the start of the week, I said how my ex's family used to take me every year to watch this. And it's at a place here in Liverpool called the Philharmonic, which they have an orchestra, the Philharmonic Orchestra. I think it might be the oldest in the world, actually, the oldest orchestra.
Okay.
But they show films in there occasionally. It's not like a proper film place, but they have a very special cinema screen. It's called a Walter Dorr cinema screen. It's the only one in the world that's left. It's very old, and it comes out of the stage. It comes out of the ground. But what I found really fascinating about this is, and inspiring to me, and inspiring to cinema, is they introduce this movie with there's an organ player on the stage. And he's been there every year doing it. I think he's been doing it for like 35, 40 years, maybe more.
Oh, wow.
He's, I feel really bad saying this. He's really old. So every year you go, you're like, I hope he's still there playing this organ. And he, every year I go and he is there, he's still doing it. And he's booked for this year. I looked on the website and I found it so cool that there's someone like this, because he started looking at his profile here that he's got. He started in the 50s playing music on the Wurlitzer and things like that. So he's been there. He's been playing music that long, and he's been doing it at the Liverpool Philharmonic, yeah, for like 30 years or something. Just someone maintaining this tradition, I found amazing, because he doesn't just do it for this. They have silent movie nights. And he'll play the music, you know, like, because they often had someone there doing it live, and he does it live, just playing the organ and everything. And I just thought, this guy is the coolest person, like, in the world. Like, that is awesome. Because in this day and age, to have that, like, I've never seen it anywhere else, personally. You might get the occasional night where they're like, we're going to show Frankenstein and someone's going to play music along with it. I've seen that. And it's like, that's not the same. This guy goes all in for the legit. It's an old organ. It's not modern. It's like a proper one that's been there for ages and ages with this cinema screen from like the 40s that doesn't exist anymore, you know. And it's just the coolest thing and the best setting to watch something like this. So it adds to the picture, you know, and you'll come out at the end and sometimes do music as well as you're leaving, you know, going to the lobbies, they're playing the organ again. And I just think this guy's immortal. This guy should live longer than Potter. He's an inspiration to me, not to play the organ, because I have no musical talent despite being part of a group.
Yeah, aren't you in a band?
Yeah, but the organ is very fancy. I would like to learn to play that kind of thing, because I think it does worry me. Who's going to carry this on? I don't want to be morbid, but when he's gone?
Well, they want John Parker to show up there.
Maybe they do, because I don't know anyone else who does it. Along to film and everything. It's like, you know, he used to be – what one did he do? He did – He did the music to Alfred Hitchcock. He did a movie in the 20s, The Lodger.
Yeah.
You could go and see him do that. He was doing the score to the whole thing. And it's like, that's just the best thing in the world.
Wow.
What a legend. What a hero. I wanted to shout out a local hero. I do have his name. Where is it? Dave Nicholas. That's what he's called. So Dave Nicholas for the Liverpool Philharmonic Hall. Coolest guy in the world. Inspiration to everyone who likes cinema.
Oh, wow. Very cool. All right. Thank you for that.
So it kind of ties into your thing, because that was my experience, was going to see him, you know?
Yeah, I think that definitely fits in there. That's great. Thank you very much for that. So, John, you want to once again tell people where they can find you?
Yes, indeed. Come and find me at the Bat Minute podcast. Again, just type these in anywhere. We've got Facebook, Twitter, X. It's not Twitter anymore. Facebook, X.
Instagram. Still refer to it as Twitter.
Yeah, I'm against dead naming, but I'll dead name your website, Elon Musk. It's Twitter. It's always going to be Twitter. Bat Minute. Hedvig Inch by Angry Inch, Miami Minutes, and if you want to check out the band I am a part of, actually, we're called Pete Bentham and the Dinner Ladies. It might not make sense to anyone in any other country. It's a very, very English sort of thing. Think of it, it's like a punk rock band doing music about real people, real things, stuff that happens in life, you know, nice, inspiring messages. But with the added camp of like Monty Python in drag. So I dress up as a dinner lady. I think in America it'd be a lunch lady. I imagine you mostly have American listeners, so I'll translate for them. So you can check us out. You might understand. The Germans seem to love it. They get on. But I think as Germans, their whole impression of English people is just, oh, they're funny. They're silly. You know.
Hey, if it works, why not?
Yeah.
All right. Great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, which, as we said, is also X. And you can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.